This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Desus and Mero, host the Showtime comedy series Desus and Mero, Sunday and Thursday nights at 11. Their third season resumed after a month-long hiatus last night. It was their first show back in the studio since the pandemic. At the heart of the show is Desus and Mero talking to each other, making each other and the audience laugh about everything from politics to viral videos, sports, pop culture, and the Bronx, where they each grew up in the 80s and early 90s. The show also has sketches, and in each show, Desus and Mero do an interview. They get high-profile guests like Barack Obama, Anthony Fauci, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Chadwick Boseman, Seth Meyers, and Chris Hayes, who went to school with Desus. Desus and Mero are the children of immigrants. Desus' parents are from Jamaica. Mero's are from the Dominican Republic. They wrote about that in their best-selling book, God-Level Knowledge Darts, Life Lessons from the Bronx, in which they give questionable but funny advice about drugs, parenting, masculinity, dealing with police, and surviving being broke. The duo started doing comedy together on Twitter, then created a podcast called Bodega Boys, which led to a TV show on Viceland, and then a TV show on Showtime. When Desus and Mero interviewed David Letterman on their Showtime series, here's what he said about them at the end of the interview.
Listen, I'm so happy for you guys. For my own ego, when I first saw the promos that you were running years ago on the Viceland outlet thing, I thought, these guys, this is it. This is the future. This is the way it ought to be. And it makes me so happy that it has come to pass that way for both of you. So
this is, bro.
Wow.
Bro.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow.
Hey, Desus and Mero, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thanks for having us.
So before you started working together, you both had a bunch of jobs before becoming like TV and audio people. So you had like legal, illegal, semi-legal kind of jobs. Tell us about some of the most interesting, ones that you've had. Desus, you want to start?
Oh, yeah, I've had a million jobs, but I think one of the most interesting jobs I had was working at the New York Public Library, because I worked there. Every job I've had, I've pretty much worked my way through the ranks. And so I started as a computer page at the library, and I worked my way all the way up to, I was almost a programmer for the New York Public Library in just a matter of years. So that, just looking back at that, that was just wild, because I was like, okay, maybe this could be like my job for the rest of my life. Because, you know, thinking back in the day, like people would have a job for 20 years with one company, but it didn't work out that way. And, you know, that was like one of the better jobs, because I've had terrible jobs. At one job, I had to collect dead rats at a auto body shop.
Whoa, I've never heard of such a job. Like a professional rat catcher.
Yeah, if you want to say professional, if you mean like a 15-year-old with Vicks vapor rub on his top lip, that's what, because the person came the week before and they put down a bait, but no one stopped to think, okay, they're going to eat the bait and die, and now there's going to be this terrible smell inside the building. And in key to the story, New York was in the middle of a heat wave, so it was about 100 degrees every day that I was working. And the only skill I had was use my nose to smell the dead rat, which was usually under a car or like behind something. Use the shovel to scoop up the dead rat, and you put it into a compound bucket, and then you dump the compound bucket into the barrel of used oil from oil changes that got picked up at the end of the week. I lasted 2 weeks at that job.
Wow. Didn't you also work managing a strip club?
I did. See, that's how wild my life is. That's not even like a job I think over the top of my head. I'm like, oh yeah, that's something I did. But we are working in different nightclubs all over New York City, working in strip clubs. That sounds like a lot more fun than it is. It's a lot of clock watching, a lot of dealing with people's personal lives like outside the club so they can come to work. It takes a lot of skill. And the only reason I got that job was because I was at a club and they were discussing the velvet ropes in front of the club, and they didn't know the name of the poles that the velvet ropes go on. And I said, you mean a stanchion? And it was like, what? And I was like, that's called a stanchion. And it was like, do you know how to use computers? And I was like, yes. And from there you go, working in a nightclub.
Wow. Mero, let's get to some of your jobs.
Oh, man. I've had every retail job you could imagine. Like, I worked at Sally Beauty Supply. I worked at an Ann Taylor Loft. I worked at, like...
Wait, you worked at an Ann Taylor Loft?
Yeah, seriously. And I was in the stock room But going back to, like, when did you know you were funny? Like, I would just make people on the crew laugh, you know what I mean? And people that my coworkers laugh or whatever. And one of the managers was, that was the first time somebody ever called me charismatic. He was just like, you're really charismatic. And I was just like, okay, that's weird. I haven't done my hair in 2 weeks and I have gold teeth. So I don't know how you find me charismatic. So then they had me on the floor, interfacing with, like, you know, all kinds of people in Manhattan and just kind of like selling them blouses.
Oh, did you have to say, that looks so adorable on you?
Yeah, like that, you know, that kind of thing. But like, I'm a Dominican guy, so like, I'm very flirtatious by nature. So I sold a lot of blouses using, you know, flirting.
Uh-huh. Okay, what else? What other jobs?
But honestly, like, the two biggest ones for me were, I worked at Lehman Brothers pre and post 9/11 and pre-collapse. And then working for the New York City Department of Education as a paraprofessional and teaching. Those were the two main ones for me. And like, the Lehman Brothers one was just soul crushing because it was just super corporate and it was just really bad. Like, the hours sucked, everything sucked. And it was just soul crushing because I would see all these people and I knew in my, like, you know, as a kid, I'd be like, you know, I'm never going to see even a quarter of the amount of money that you see. Like, you have 16 monitors in front of you and you're talking about finance and stuff. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I just know that you will be rich forever and I will be broke forever and I'm going to be changing your water and bringing your mail until I perish.
When you were working in a public school as a teacher's aide or paraprofessional, what did you have to do? Because I remember I taught very briefly before I was fired. So I walked in and, like, there was a paraprofessional or teacher's aide. I forget what his official job was. And he looked at me and he said, basically, you're not going to make it. and then he gave me some advice, and I want to know if you follow this advice. He said, what I do with the students, if a kid's bad, I take him out of the class, and I holler at him so everybody could hear, and then I start kicking the locker so people think I'm, like, throwing him against the locker, but I'm not. I'm just kicking him. And I thought, like, wow, thanks for being such a great role model for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know what it is? Some of those, it's case by case. You know what I mean? That's the thing, too. Like, it's kind of like being a coach. Like, you have a team, your roster of students, and each one is different. Some of them, you do have to give them, like, tough love and be like, you know, whatever. And I worked in at Junior High School 117, my alma mater, shout out to them. And it's on 176th Street and Morris Avenue in the Bronx. Like, you know, it's the South Bronx. It's not the... A great gentrified up-and-coming neighborhood, blah, 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 whatever you want to call it. So, you know, a lot of those kids, both their parents are working, single parents, some of them are in shelters. So, like, you know, like, I know where a lot of the anger comes from, or a lot of that, like, you know, quote-unquote acting out. So in that situation, you approach it differently versus a kid who has a stable home, has a PlayStation 5, both parents work, they make money, they're doing well, but you're just like, you just want to be a smartass. So if you just want to be a smartass, I can play that game too. You know what I mean? It's kind of like finding out, like, who's really going through it versus who's just, like, kind of messing around, you know? And I was like, I called myself, like, a bouncer, teacher, crisis, you know, prevention manager, whatever you want to, like, so many different hats on any given day.
It sounds like you were really good at it.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the thing too. Like, I stepped into it thinking, like, I have to be khaki Van Heusen button-up man, you know, for these kids to take me seriously. And then I was just like, because, you know, I'm a 20-something-year-old kid, so I was just like, you know, they're not going to take me seriously. They're going to think I'm, like, one of their older brothers if I come in dressing like how I normally dress. So I have to dress the part. And that was my biggest mistake, because my first day, a kid told me, you know, something that rhymes with, you know, tuck my brick, when I asked him to read something. And it was, and then the next day I came in and I was just like, you know what? I'm going to show these kids that I'm from here. Like, I'm from the same community you're from. I'm not, you know, some transplant from New Hampshire. Like, I graduated from the school. Like, I know this neighborhood. I probably know you. I probably beat your uncle up. So the next day I came in dressed like I normally dress, you know, hoodie, Yankee hat. And then I went and I sent one of the kids up to the library to get the yearbook from 97, which was the year I graduated. And I opened it up and I said, look, at class 8 to 21, who's there? And they were like, oh, snap, mister, yo, that's you, yo, that's you. And I was just like, yes, that's me. So now we're going to move a little bit different. And I got to, you know, I kind of put my foot down a little bit, and that ended up working out. Because then them looking at me as an older brother ended up working out for me, because they would tell me stuff that they wouldn't tell the teacher or that they wouldn't tell the counselor.
Right.
And then I can go tell the counselor, or I could just offline with the parent personally and be like, yo, listen, your son, your daughter, whoever told me this, you know, I'm a little worried about it. Just put it on your radar in case you're not aware of it.
You're both the children of immigrants, and Miro, your parents are from the Dominican Republic, and Desus, your parents are from Jamaica. Did they each tell you a lot about, like, their backstories and why they came to New York?
All the time. I think that's, like, the immigrant parent trope, is, like, they tell you constantly how much they struggled and sacrificed so that you could have a better life. And it's true. Like, now that I'm, you know, a 38-year-old man with four children myself, I understand exactly where they're coming from. When you're 10 years old, you kind of don't want to hear it. But as an adult, it's like, you know, that work ethic, that drive is instilled in you early. You know what I mean? Because it's like, I can't even imagine. Like, my parents came here, you know, in their early 20s. It's like, yo, I'm going to, as a 20-something-year-old, imagine moving to a place where you don't know the language, you don't know the lay of the land, you don't know anybody there. You're just going there with a couple of bucks and trying to make it happen. And that, just that idea is terrifying to me at 38. So I can't even imagine doing it at, like, you know, 22, 21. They're just built different. So, like, you know, to honor them and to kind of show, like, hey, look, you know, this was not in vain. Like, look at what we've accomplished, like, the three of us, because I have two siblings, you know, and they, all the three of us did what we set out to do, which is, you know, come here and be successful and then pay it forward, you know.
Yeah, growing up with my parents, definitely, looking back, they weren't like, look, I did this to, like, berate me or anything. I think looking back, like, they were just trying to process it themselves, to be that young with young children in a country to understand. That adds, like, a different level of stress I can't even imagine. And looking back, I just always remember my parents stressing about the idea that they came to this country to give me a chance so that I wouldn't just, you know, just squander it. Because especially growing up in the Bronx, it wasn't that hard to, like, fall in with the wrong crowd, end up selling drugs or running around with guns and stuff like that. And that would have totally just been a waste of time for what my parents were trying to accomplish. And then also living where I lived at the time growing up, I lived in the northeastern part of the Bronx, which is affectionately referred to as Little Jamaica because it has a huge West Indian population. And there's a lot of Jamaican stores and restaurants and supermarkets. So growing up, there was definitely a sense of community because everyone around me basically was Jamaican, to the point where until I got older and started exploring, I thought all of New York was like that. So it was kind of shocking to go to Manhattan. I'm like, hey, there's no beef patty stores down here. But, you know, definitely parents instilled that in that and always put that in me. So it was always in the back of my head. Also, that immigrant work ethic, where that is just like you have to work harder than other people, because not that you have more to prove, but you got more at stake. There's no plan B. There's no, like, safety net for you to fall on. And that, to this day, I continue doing that every day when we do work.
So you both grew up in the Bronx in the 1980s and 90s. And, I mean, the Bronx was kind of like, during that period, it was kind of like the capital of graffiti and hip-hop culture. Which parts of that were most important in your life?
I remember like, I grew up in a household where, like, we didn't speak English. Like, I didn't speak English until I went to school. So hearing hip-hop and hearing the Jungle Brothers Straight Out of the Jungle for the first time, like, blew my mind. Like, literal, like I was like, what is this? This is like, next level. This is the future or whatever. So, you know, shout out to my cousin Patty, because I used to just, like, raid her like vinyl and like cassette collection or whatever and listen to all types of stuff. But graffiti, like, I just, and to this day, like, I'm just, like, obsessed. Like, I don't know if I can even explain it. It's just like it's an addiction that I'm not mad I have. I think I said that same exact thing verbatim in the book, but yeah, it's just like, it's so much fun. It's like an adrenaline rush. And then you drive, it's like putting your autograph somewhere and then you go and you see your autograph. later on. You know what I mean? I don't know. I can't explain it to like a non-graffiti writer, but like it just, it's like, there's kind of like a, there's this rush where you see, like if I paint a one of those like white box trucks and I just see it, like I paint it in the Bronx and then I see it out somewhere on a highway in New Jersey. I'm like, yo, wow. You know what I mean? Like at least 15 to 20 people have seen my name rolling down the highway.
So did you learn English in part by listening to rap?
Definitely. Music, television, older cousins that were bilingual, but mostly like pop culture, TV, music, stuff like that. Like I learned a lot of stuff from Saved by the Bell.
But if you were learning English in part from rap, like you learned English in part in rhyme.
Yeah. Which is funny because like I'm always coming up with these weird like phrases or catchphrases or whatever, and I feel like that's kind of like what hip hop did to me. Like it made me think in like couplets. You know what I'm saying? Like whenever I'm writing or talking or whatever. But yeah, no, like that definitely influenced the way like I speak. Period.
What was your best way of hiding from police when you were doing graffiti?
All black. Outfit, you know, if it's summertime, black t-shirt, black pants, sweatpants, shorts, whatever, and nothing reflective, maybe a bandana, you know what I'm saying? But the best thing really is to just have a black plastic bag from a bodega full of paint and just walk down the street like you're minding your business. That's the thing. That's the best disguise is no disguise when you're doing graffiti.
Right. Desus, what were the parts of hip-hop and graffiti culture that you most identified with or were part of?
For me, it was more music, because my father, he was a DJ in Jamaica, and then when he came to America, he still had like a lot of vinyl and things like that. Because he had to work, he didn't really have time to DJ anymore. But I always like saw the records and saw like when he would play music or how excited he would get when he'd have cookouts and barbecues, and like he'd like arrange the music a certain way. And because of that, like I was always listening to like old school Jamaican music, old school dancehall, which helped me, you know, when you start hearing those samples in KRS-One and different levels of hip hop. And then having so many sisters, they would always be playing hip hop. My older sister would always play like Tribe Called Quest. Whatever new albums came out, she'd be the way I'd find out about stuff because I was too young to go out on my own. And not only that, my sisters, they'd date guys and the guys would come around and they'd play brand new music from like their neighborhood. Like, so that's how I found out about like Heavy D and Pete Rock and all those people from Mount Vernon, which is located right above New York, because those guys would come visit my sisters and they'd have like albums and stuff there. So I was always growing up, that was always the vibe of New York City for me, like just trying to like move from basically one hip-hop album to another. And shout out to my man G Steel, we used to actually go to vinyl stores. We'd cut school and just go, not just to buy new vinyl, but we'd go and we'd like what we call digging in the crates, where you just look through, because there's no turntable at the time, so you had to like kind of look for old records and judge them basically by their cover. And then when you go home, you listen to them. And we weren't producers at the time, but when something we really liked to do was find an old record and identify a sample. And so you'd buy these old albums and you'd just be listening to all these old tracks, and then you'd hear like a 30-second sample and you take it back. And this is way before the internet. This is before there was any like pop culture easy way for you to identify samples. And then you'd figure out, oh, DJ Premier sampled this track for this Nas song. And then like, you know, I'd call my boy G and try to ride on my bike over to his house to play the record for him. And that's the kind of like hip hop nerd stuff we were doing back in the day.
Desus, your mother was a librarian. Did you grow up with a lot of books? And I should mention, in the acknowledgments of your book, you say that you, I think it was in the acknowledgments, you say that you were an English major. Shout out to Jane Eyre.
Yes.
I was surprised to see Jane Eyre.
Oh, yeah. That was a shout out to my mother. My mother was, when she returned to the workforce after having four kids, she was a tutor at the CRW in the New York Public Library. And my mother started there. From there, she worked her way up to being the branch librarian at the Soundview Library. But yeah, my mother instilled a love of books at a very early age with us. The library, when they do circulation, and if a book isn't being rotated or no one's reading it, they throw the book away. That's just like the weeding and seeding of the New York Public Library. So my mother would always come home with books. for us to read almost on a weekly basis. So there was always this, she would always stress the need to read and a love of reading in our house. And the Jane Eyre, that shout out was shout out to College of Mount St. Vincent, where I started as a computer science major, and I actually was learning programming languages faster than they were teaching them. So my mother was like, why don't you just fall back and be an English major? You can get any job with like an English degree. And I said, yeah. And I was pretty much the only male in my Jane Eyre class at College of Mount St. Vincent, which was super hilarious.
Yeah, it sounds it. Mary, you described yourself when you were interviewing David Letterman, you described yourself as a hellacious teenager. What made you hellacious?
Well, it's part of it was just kind of like rebelling, because like kind of like what Deezus said, my mom is a teacher, a former teacher, retired now, shout out to her, you know, did her thing. And she was like a really good teacher and a really good manager of classrooms, you know what I mean? Like, that's a big thing when you're an educator, is classroom management. Like, can you keep these 40 kids engaged? And my mom was teaching at a time when that it was not uncommon to have like a 40 child roster, you know, in your room. So she was a math teacher, so that was like her thing. And she also was very cognizant of like, English is my second language. I can speak English and I can communicate well in English, but I have an accent and people judge me for that. So she was just like super, like, you need to learn how to read and write in English the way that they do here, or else people are going to judge you and think, you know what I mean? Like, just, they're going to say, oh, you're not American. You're from somewhere else because you don't sound like I sound or whatever. So every single summer I went to the Dominican Republic to visit family, but we did not go without an entire duffel bag full of workbooks, novels, you know, math, drills, like it was like going to school year round with my mom. So, to answer your question, I was a hellacious teenager probably because I was rebelling against that, but it worked out because I ended up mixing those two worlds, like running around in the street, doing all the street stuff, but also having like the book smarts that my mom kind of made me enjoy. Like, you know, it got to a point where it was just like, oh, this is just a thing that I do, like eating and breathing. Like I'm doing math. I'm actively reading. I'm learning to read and write in Spanish and in English, just because it's like, you know, it's an asset. My mom knew that. So she just made it part. She just made it normal. You know, it was part of my everyday life. So I didn't feel like, oh, I'm missing out, or like, oh, my cousins are out at the river swimming and I'm home, you know, reading Animal Farm, you know, but like,
yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's just like, you know, it helped me realize earlier than the other kids that, you know, Animal Farm isn't just a book about pigs being in charge, you know, themes and things like that in writing and literature, whatever, is something that kind of became apparent to me real young.
What did masculinity mean to each of you when you were growing up? What did being a, you know, proving that you were a man mean? What did it require?
For me, it was my dad is weird because he never was like, this is what a man does. Like, I saw him cooking alongside my mom. I saw him cleaning the house alongside my mom. My dad, you know, would cry and not be ashamed to cry. I always felt like people always kind of said masculinity has to be like being a stoic and like, you know, be a man, like man up. But my dad was just like, listen, being a man is being you, you know, and taking care of what you got to take care of. But that's just being a human. So like, you know, now that I'm 38, I'm like, well, dad, that's just being a responsible human being. But I guess that's what he meant all along. The concept of masculinity is like whatever you want it to be.
And this is what message did you get from about masculinity from your family, but also from friends and from people who weren't necessarily your friends?
It was never really the kind of thing where it was stressed on you about be a man. You got to be a man. You got to do this. You got to stand up, especially in my house because there were so many girls. There was no real like masculinity stuff going on. It was just like we were just raised as kids. But then when I started hanging in the streets with like older guys, because those were like the closest things to brothers I had, I just remember them, they weren't the most woke people and they did terrible crimes and they were terrible people. But I do remember one of the things that they stressed to me was masculinity is very important about being able to be proud of the person you are when you look at yourself in the mirror, and that you shouldn't define who you are based on what other people say or think about you. And at the time, that didn't sound that revolutionary, but you have to think about it in terms of, if someone steps on your sneakers and you shoot them, are you a man for that? You're in jail now. And little things like that, that taught you a different way to view masculinity going forward.
Well, you know, you're both now like LGBTQ allies. How did you get to that point? I mean, did you grow up with homophobia and with gay being used as a, you know, derogatory term?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially being in a Caribbean community, like, you know, you have very popular songs that are about murdering gay people. And you grow up, you don't even realize that's what the song is about, or you're just singing it at like a family barbecue. Everyone's jumping around laughing because that's so so ingrained in Caribbean culture because of slavery and religion and so many different things. And you don't even realize that you're being homophobic. Like, some of the gay slurs are just actual curse words that you use if you stub your toe. So when you grow up like that, it can become hard for you to realize that you're being homophobic, or you're not being woke, but, you know, you're being hurtful. But my parents did a good job of making sure we weren't raised in a way like that, to the point where one of my little sister's friends, a Jamaican kid, his mother threw him out the house for being gay. Literally no other reason, just because he was gay. And she was like, you're not going to do that under my roof. And he came and he lived with us for a year. And that was like my little brother. And he would ask me questions that I tried to answer as much as I could. But I was like, I only know so much about the subject. And my parents were completely fine. They didn't charge him any rent. They just let him live in the house because he had nowhere else to go. And shout out to Derek, who we raised. Like, that lesson right there just really showed me how important it is to be an ally for people and to be in people's lives. Because if you're not there, who do they have?
Well, that's great. And Mira, what about you? Like, your mother-in-law is a lesbian, right?
Yes. And my shout out to Judy. Shout out to Claudia. I love, you know, loves of my life. Beautiful women. And that, to me, that was like not a thing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just like, oh, you know, it's, this is your mom and your mom, you know, and your stepmom, pardon. And it, like, it's weird because, like, I feel like that's like a plot to like a 90s movie. Like, you know what I mean? Like, Dominican guy meets Jewish girl at work. They fall in love. Whoa, his mother-in-law's gay. Whoa, that's wacky. How are they going to get along? But like, Claudia's a great person, Judy's a great person, and like, I just like good people. Like, I don't care who you sleep with at the end of the night, who you marry, who you date, whatever's going on with you. Like, I just kind of never cared about that type of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't know. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's a weird question to answer because it's almost, like I said, growing up in New York City, you see it so much. It's just like a fact of life. It's just like, yo, you're Puerto Rican, you're gay. You know what I mean? Like, it's just another category of New Yorker. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, but like you said, there was so much homophobia in pop culture and in hip hop at the time. So just to balance what you just said.
Right, yeah. And it's so bizarre that there was so much of it, but it didn't, I don't know, it didn't take root in me.
Mary, you said that you realized you had to find a way, and I'm paraphrasing here, to turn hopelessness into comedy. Was that like a revelation you had? Or is that something you just naturally did?
Yeah, no, it was just natural. Because it was like, I had to laugh at the roaches in my apartment. I couldn't do anything about it. You know what I mean? I had to laugh at, like, you know, drinking water and going to bed because I didn't have anything to eat. I'm a broken record with this phrase, but it's just like, the best art is honest art. And if you're being honest and you're telling the truth and you're being transparent about your background, who you are, where these jokes are coming from, what inspired these jokes, you know what I mean? I feel like it's gonna come out a lot easier and cleaner. It's not gonna be forced. So like, yeah, man, like, I literally would turn on the light in my apartment and like do like Savion Glover tap dance all over the place to kill all these roaches. And no matter how much bleach I tossed all around the place, it didn't matter because I lived in a building where my neighbor was gross. So I had, by transitive property, I had roaches, you know what I mean? So things like that, like a cop spray painting brand new shoes, not getting arrested, like having cops just mess with you. that's like, it's deflating. You know, I'd rather you book me. You know what I mean? And like, at least I'll get like a sandwich.
Wait, so they'd spray paint your shoes?
Yeah, that happened to me a bunch of times. They'd spray paint my stuff. Throw, you know.
Would they use your spray paint to do it?
Yeah.
And but they'd do that instead of arresting you?
Yeah. They'd throw you up, put you in cuffs, spray your shoes, spray your shirt,
and then release you,
and then uncuff you, and then be like, "Yo, get out of here, you piece of, you know, expletive."
And. In retrospect?
In retrospect, I'm like, I don't know if that was better or worse than getting arrested, because I got a pretty clean record, but I'm like, man, like, that sucked. You know what I mean? Like, how many pairs of shoes did I ruin, you know?
So while we're on the subject of police, did you have serious incidents with police when you were growing up?
It depends on what you mean by serious, because like it's so wild to me, because growing up I just thought this stuff was normal. I thought stop and frisk was a normal police thing. You know what I mean? Like, come to find out, like, yo, you're violating my rights. You're stopping me for absolutely no reason, just because I look how I look, and you're rifling through my pockets, and all I did was go to the store to get a Snapple. You know what I mean? And I thought that was normal. Because that, I had no other frame of reference for that. So now, like, when you ask that question, it's just like, okay, what's the barometer for that? Is it a cop putting a gun in your face? Because that's happened to me a bunch of times. Is it a cop, you know, driving the wrong way down a one-way street in an unmarked car that you don't know? Is this like a beef that I have with somebody? You know, and just that terror, that instant, like, I wish people could, like, when people talk about encounters with police, like, I want to just have them feel that feeling for like 3 seconds, that sheer terror. That's happened to me. And I've been in a situation where I'm just like, man, like, you know, what's going to happen right now? Is this a cop? Is this not a cop? Is this somebody pretending to be a cop? Or, you know what I mean? Like, that's one situation I'll never forget. Like, I'm coming down. I'm literally going to the corner store or the bodega to get some, you know, roll up in and go back in my house. Or my girlfriend's house, you know, who I lived with at the time. And a marked car comes blowing it down a one-way street the wrong way. Jumps out, and they all jump out and they throw me up against the wall. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And they're like, you know, well, there's so-and-so's, you know, armed robberies, blah, 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 you know, BS reason why we're stopping you. I just remember being scared to death. That fear is real. And it's funny because people are like, why are you, well, if you run from police, you should expect a blah, blah, blah. Nah, man, you don't understand. Like, this is like almost animal instinct. It's like fight or flight. And you're not going to fight police.
Yeah, I got arrested by NYPD and they falsely charged me for having a gun.
And what were the consequences of that?
I beat that with a public defender. Because you know what the thing is? It was my local precinct. They're lazy. They didn't fill out the right paperwork. I remember the office. It was a black officer that I remember him pointing at me and saying that he saw me with the gun. I know he didn't. And we made eye contact. Like, I know you're lying. And I remember there was one cop that was like, I don't think, like, it was like, listen to how he talks. Listen, like, he's following everything we're telling him to do. I don't think he was running around the Bronx with a gun. And all the other officers were like, shut up. We know what we're doing. And that cop just stopped. He stopped. That was the only person that night that was like, yo, this, you have the wrong guy. But thankfully, shout out to the Bronx Defenders, which provide legal services to Bronx people who don't have a lot of money. They were able to get the charges dropped. And the weirdest thing is the reason the charges dropped was the assistant DA in the Bronx recognized me from brunch at Red Rooster in Harlem. And was like, there's no way he would have been running around the city with a gun. So they got the charges thrown out. But even that, I just think about so many things had to go right for me not to end up in jail for 3 years, that there's definitely people on Rikers and in prison who just got bamboozled and got railroaded. And they're telling you, yo, I did not have a gun, and no one wants to hear them. So even that interaction right then and there, that just really changes the way you view the legal system and just every incident with cops and just even interacting with the cops, because we have cops that come up to us and they're like, oh, I love your show. And I'm just like, fam, if the situation's reverse, you might be the person arresting me or worse. So I don't even know if I could really enjoy the fact that you're watching the show if you're not getting the messages we're telling you about policing on the show.
Yeah. You talk about politics a lot on the show, both in your riffing with each other, but also with guests. with AOC, with Bernie Sanders, with lots of other people. You interviewed Obama, and it seemed to me like he knew your show. Are you ever doing your show and thinking, oh, Obama might be listening?
But it was something we always thought about in the past, but now it's just like, now you're just like, oh, Obama's listening? I'm going to definitely do this joke. Because what's he going to do? He has to sit there in the living room and take it. And Michelle's sitting there like, ah, you can't do anything about it, Barry. But no, it's like, that's the beauty of being on Showtime. You have a higher platform and just more people listening to you. And every now and then we'll do a joke, and like a celebrity or someone we did the joke about, they'll come up and they'll be like, that joke was hilarious. That joke was hilarious. And that's part of the growth of the platform, because it's just like, knowing that you're doing jokes and that you're going to have to one day come across these people you're making jokes about, you have to do these jokes with your chest. You have to say them confidently, because the worst thing you want to do is have someone come up, run up on you like, yo, why'd you say this? And you got to be all like, oh, I didn't mean that. Da 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 da. You know what I'm saying? Like, we've had that had in the past now. And since we've dealt with that, we're not ever going to have that happen again. So now, and most people are good sports about it. Most people, you get a text message like, oh, you cooked me, or oh, you roasted me on that. And people, they understand it's comedy. And at the end of the day, it's just jokes. And that's a good feeling.
Well, Desus and Mero, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You can see Desus and Mero Sunday and Thursday nights on Showtime. Their book is called God-Level Knowledge Darts, Life Lessons from the Bronx.